Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome to the lecture this evening. I'm Roger Silverstone. I'm director, well, actually, I'm now convener of the Department of Media and Communication. Can't hear you? Can't hear me? Is that better?
Good. Yes, interact.
I'll do my best. I'm Roger Silverstone. I'm convener of the Department of Media and Communication. And it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome Hossam El Sokari, who is head of BBC Arabic across the road and the BBC World Service. And Mr. Sokari is a cartoonist who worked for the BBC Arabic television service until it was closed down in 1996, perhaps not the best decision the BBC has ever made, after which he went to Al Jazeera for a year and then came back to the BBC. He's an alum of the London School of Economics, having done a master's in ADMIS in the Department of Information Systems in 1998, and we're very pleased to welcome him this evening. His topic of the talk this evening, and I think he's impressed upon me that it's a talk rather than a lecture, and an interactive one at that, is called Interactivity, Passing the Buck to the Audience. Welcome, Mr. El Sokari. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. I think I have to see how I start that. I think it's very difficult to start anything about media without making a reference to Marshall McLuhan, the man who gave us the opportunity to use quite a number of phrases about the global village, about the medium being the message, about technologies being an extension of man. And I was an advocate and a believer in Marshall McLuhan, especially in his statement about the medium being the message. But I was converted. And that was in Cairo, 2002. And my guru at the time was my baba, Hag Ali, who, while I was having a haircut there, somebody passed by his shop, and he was trying to sell him something like a can or a bottle of oil, which looked a little bit weird. It had a tap on the side. Hag Ali was so fascinated by this sort of invention, and he asked him, how much does it cost? The man said, £25 full and £24 empty. And Hag Ali was so disappointed. I mean, it cannot be true. The content inside the bottle is not more than £1 worth, and the bottle is 24. And he looked at me and said, well, do you think this is right? You know, I felt his blade on my neck. And I said, well, of course not. You know, it can't be right. But thinking about it, I think probably he was a little bit right, especially when we see that over the past years, with the introduction of communication dissemination technologies or information dissemination technologies, and with a strong emphasis on the technology around it, or those people who were working on websites kept on saying all the time, well, content is very important. You know, these flashy images are not very important. You know, the mouse and the interface, I mean, it's important, but the important thing is the content. The content is what drives people to our sites. It is not necessarily the technology. It's not necessarily the format. It's not necessarily how it looks. But what is the value of content? I mean, content is valuable, but what is the valuable content, and what is content that is not valuable, and how can content drive people to your product, whether it's a website, a TV channel, a radio station, a newspaper? We'll come back to that, but I would like to talk a little bit more about interactivity and definitions of interactivity, because this is a puzzling thing, and this is probably one of the axes of this sort of lecture/chat. Oxford English Dictionary puts two definitions, one for humans, in a way. It says it's being interactive, or interactive is influencing each other. And the other one is more related to electronic devices or computers. It says allowing a two-way flow of information between it and the user, responding to the user's output. And it's not very much different than a very long definition that you'll find on itvdictionary.com, which is a site built by interactive television industrialists. And after this very long definition, it says here that the three primary forms, as of this writing, to experience interactivity with television programming are set-top boxes based, screen TV, and PDAs and mobile phones. And it's a little bit intriguing, especially if you look for further definitions, for example, on interactivity, which again puts a lot of emphasis on the technology behind it, on the idea of interactivity being a response to information input to a machine, a human-machine interaction, or a human-computer interaction. And this one says it's the relationship between the human operator and the technology, the human-computer interface, HCI perspective. In brief, this involves interactivity as relating to a wide range of disciplines, including software engineering, computational linguistics, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, understanding, thought, creativity, sociology, ergonomics, organizational psychology, mathematics, cognitive psychology, and social psychology. Are you intimidated enough by this one? But I beg to differ a little bit, because from that, we seem to understand that interactivity is, in simple terms, a machine response to an input that you introduce. And in that sense, I can argue that it's not only the red buttons that will turn a machine into an interactive machine. Any button will turn a machine into an interactive machine. As long as you have an input and you get an output, then any machine can be interactive. My TV set, my old TV set, is an interactive machine. My radio set is an interactive machine. Actually, not only that, my door is an interactive machine. My chair is an interactive machine. I mean, if you push it, it's pushed. If you open things, it opens. And welcome to my interactive door, you know. This is also interactive. So interactivity in that sense is not something I'm really comfortable with as a concept. I would be more comfortable with another definition. It's not really a definition, because Bertolt Brecht, when he put this, I mean, it took me some time to train myself on Brecht, so please appreciate that. It was 1926 when he was talking about radio, and he said radio is one-sided when it should be two. It should let the listeners speak as well as hear, bring them into a relationship instead of isolating them. Radio should step out of the supply business and organize its listeners as suppliers. Hence the idea of passing the buck to the listeners or the audience, because interactivity, in a way, is incorporating user-generated content in your output. It's making a little bit of space to the people that you are lecturing all the time. Hence my reservation on the word lecture also at the beginning. You know, if we turn it interactive, you will be sitting here and I will be sitting there, and you tell me what the lecture is about. But lots of things have changed. I mean, technology has had an influence on the way we work as media professionals. But the introduction of interactivity is not really a very new thing. And there are lots of changes that were the basis or the result of the introduction of the new information or the new technologies, the new communication technologies. Because things now seem to be much more quick, easy, and much cheaper. For people to involve in mass communication process or to create a mass communication product, it was a very expensive business. You know, you have to have a lot of money, and this is why either very rich people or states were able to do that. You know, they were able to build newspapers, TV stations, radio channels, and they were able to impose their thoughts and ideas on you as audiences. But things are changing now, and the challenge is coming from the users. The users now are able to do things that are very similar to what we as media professionals were doing. They are challenging the ability of big organizations and states to disseminate information on wide scale without having to spend as much money or to be engaged in a very complicated process of publishing or broadcasting. If you look at the Middle East, some of the most popular sites are the chat rooms and the bulletin boards. And these are extremely popular, and it's threatening in a way, because it makes you feel that we are sort of dividing our worlds into two, because the realities that are being discussed and the facts that are being displayed on these sites are very different sometimes from what you read in newspapers and magazines. And the challenge is there on various levels. I don't know if any of you have seen this site, but this is one of the sites that were used to disseminate the beheading videotapes of the people that were hijacked in Iraq. And it defies my understanding to know that some of these websites are hosted in the United States, but still it's a fact that those people managed to get through, even if we agree as media professionals, for example, that some of these pictures and images we are not going to be showing on TV screens. You will hardly see that on TV screens. But you will see quite a lot of that on websites. The unfortunate images of beheadings and killings, you will see that on websites. And that is a challenge because the monopoly is not there anymore. The monopoly that we enjoyed as media professionals on behalf of those who own the newspapers, the magazines, the radio stations, and the TV stations, and the websites is not there anymore. Users are challenging that. And therefore, it probably is not, I mean, we are not probably sometimes, I think, that we are not talking about interactivity and engaging users actually and involving them in the production process itself. I'm thinking sometimes that we are doing that because we're opportunists in a way. You know, we're just saying, okay, well, fine, don't go away. You know, come back. You know, I'm going to give you a little bit of space with me. You know, take part in the production process and help me do something different. Help me do it better. Help me do it in a way that can engage you. And of course, the challenge will be to keep the balance between keeping your values and doing what your audiences want you to do. But this is, you know, this is part of the game. This is part of the dialectic between you and them. Therefore, when you look at these images from the beginning of the century, these were war posters. And it's not only war posters that you can read there. This was one way of communication. It's. I feel sometimes that this is how we, as media professionals, in the beginning of the previous century, were communicating with our audiences. You know, you listen to us. We tell you the truth. You know nothing. You know, we will give you the analysis. You know nothing. You have to listen to me. And the truth is what I tell you. Nothing else. And if you see how things are changing now, you'll see how we are. I mean, when we are training presenters, for example, we're talking about something completely different. Before we were talking about authority and, you know, being able, you know, using your voice to be authoritative, and, you know, when it comes to an image, it's exactly the same thing. But now we are talking about being friendly, you know, being nice to your audiences. You know, you have to bring them to you, just, you know, but don't intimidate them because they are nice people. You are a nice person, so you have to, you know, just don't push it too far. And we're not talking about facts or realities. We're not telling people now that we are telling you the truth. We're telling people now that we are giving them as much as we can of the views and the perspectives that are on the ground, and they can make their mind, you know, their own mind about it. You know, we're not saying that we monopolize anything now. So everything is on the table. You can pick and choose. All what we do is that we are going to provide you with as much as we can, but don't go away. But what this meant for us in the BBC Arabic Service was that we have to change quite a lot of what we have been doing. The BBC Arabic Service is not a very young service in terms of years. It was established back in 1938, January 15. I wasn't there, but I was told. And it became a very, I mean, there was a point when the BBC Arabic Service was the only choice that people have in the Middle East to have or to hear a different view as compared to what they receive from state broadcasting, whether in TV or in radio. And we had different, over the years, we introduced different services. I mean, the BBC Arabic Service Radio is the one that has been there continuously from 1938. But we had at least tried three times our hands on publications. We had three different publications over the more than 65 years. We had a BBC Arabic television back in 1994, closed down in 1996. We started an internet operation that is a very successful one. We started that in 1999 as a 24/7 operation. And now I think it's the benchmark in the Middle East in terms of content and information. And what we wanted to do is to try to understand a little bit more about our audiences and to see how we can engage them more. The evidence for the way our audiences engage with us is there, and I can see it when I travel across the Middle East. I was in Amman and I found this. BBC, this is not the BBC that you know. This is not the British Broadcasting Corporation. This is Bakri Brothers Center. Yeah? And Bakri and his brothers decided to use the BBC as a name for the supermarket because it's a brand, and it means trust. And they're not the only ones. You know, this lady, I came across here in Cairo, actually, and I'm sure, my apologies, because the picture is a little bit hazy, but this is a dinner set, a BBC dinner set, written exactly the same way. This is the typeface that we use. I don't know how they nicked it. So this tells me that, you know, those who manufacture these products or name the supermarkets after the BBC in the Middle East or their language schools know what the brand value of the BBC is, and they're trying to use it. So it means a lot for us to get people to be engaged with us, and it means a lot to them also to be a part of our production, to be part of our output. But there is a problem. And the problem, I think, is a very similar problem to the problem that parents face when their kids are never convinced that the burger that is made at home is cleaner and tastier than the one you buy at Burger King. You know, anything that is industrially manufactured seems to have a value that is higher than that you produce yourself. And information is no exception. You know, information that is being processed and manufactured by corporations, states, countries, big people, seems sometimes to have a value that is higher or more important than that of sort of self-manufactured information, your own views and thoughts. And this is a challenge, actually. The problem is not to convince users with that. The problem, in part, is to convince professionals with that, to convince them that user-generated content is as valuable and sometimes more valuable than professional-generated content. And when we try to do this, we try to augment what we do on the BBC site, on the bbcarabic.com site, and what we do in BBC in the BBC Arabic Service Radio. And the challenging moment was the war in Iraq last year. I was sitting there and chatting with some of my bosses, and there are quite a number of them, about what we can do after the war erupted. And I, you know, suggested just, you know, out of the blue, that we probably can start some kind of phone-in program whereby the content of the program would be the user's views and thoughts of the war. And they said, okay, well, let's try it. You know, shall we do it tomorrow? Maybe for a couple of days, and that will be it. Fine, let's do it. After the first episode, I mean, our lines were jammed with phone calls. After the first episode, I went back to my boss and said, "Okay, what do you want to do now? Shall we do tomorrow's episode, or I mean, I was in the studio. I don't know what was happening outside. But do you think we can do another one, or shall we, you know, call it a day?" And they said, "We're actually not going to do another one. We'll do it twice a day. Every episode will be 1 hour, and we'll do it 6 days a week." Well, fine, okay. So I kept on doing that for months before I had to scale it down for health reasons, And after that, we started introducing other ways of dealing with that content. It became so bad. I was intrigued. I mean, my wife, who is here actually, was complaining because I was talking about nothing else but what I'm hearing from people. Because it helped me remodel my views of what people think or what people's views are. It's completely different. We seem to have our mind framed in a way around what we think people want, what we think people say, what we think they like, and what we think they don't like. And there are something like 3 or 4 fictional figures that we have in mind. You know, when I worked in newspapers, people were always talking about the reader. You know, we are in a sort of an editorial meeting, and somebody, "No, the readers wouldn't like that." You know, and somebody, no, "The readers would like that." And I don't know who are the readers. You know, they are fictional figures in our heads, and we seem to think that they are like us. You know, so what we like is what the readers will like, or if they don't like, they will have to like it, you know, or else. And I changed my views on that because I discovered that there is a lot more diversity than we thought, and I discovered that people would like to hear that. It's not really true that people like to hear their own selves or their own views. It is not true. They like to be challenged. And one of the revealing moments, because the program started in a way and it developed in a slightly different way. In the beginning, I was happy to listen to different views, and then afterwards, I was happy to confront people with views of other people who are sending emails to us. And in one occasion, I was discussing, you know, somebody, you know, phoned, and he was, you know, talking about his views and perceptions of the war and so on and so forth. And I was either busy or I didn't find anything to say. And then I moved to the second listener. Went back to my office and I found an email. Complaint. He was complaining, you know. "You didn't interrupt me. And you didn't contradict me. And you didn't get any other views from the website as you often do. Am I worthless?" And I said, "Well, hang on. I mean, this is a guy that likes to be, you know, confronted. I mean, it seems to me that people are not really in favor of the idea of being, you know, treated like a barber, you know, like being treated in a barber shop. You know, just you have your haircut and you go and the next one comes. They like to be taken seriously. And even when we introduce the idea of having pundits and experts and analysts in the programs, we never did it in the way that very often is done in other sort of outlets. I.e., you invite the experts, they explore the issue, they tell you what the facts are, what the backgrounds are, and then afterwards the people, you know, the laymen, the ordinary people, will have a chance, if there is any time left, to say something. You know, but we didn't do that. When we had analysts, they usually come midway through. They usually come during the program. And I have to say that some of them were very upset about it, and some of them liked the experience. But some of them felt that this is somehow a threat to the status that they have acquired over the years. We are there to be listened to. We are not there to be contradicted. So listeners, in a way, were very flexible. They wanted to be contradicted, and they wanted to be discussed. And pundits and experts and analysts were not happy with that. You know, our views are sacred. We have to tell you what things are like, and you have to accept it. So from that, we developed our site to be a complementing offer, or actually both services were complementing one another. So we put the themes on the site, we publish some of the views that we receive, we have the live program on air, and then we use some of the content that we receive, and we get some of these messages to identify the themes that people would like to talk about, and then we contact them, and then we host them in the program. It was a very interactive process in which their content was the theme of the show. Even more, we use them to guide us to what they really want to talk about. And I do remember that, I mean, some of the themes and the issues that they came up with were issues that I've never thought of. I didn't know that we can discuss, for example, racism against black people in the Middle East. I never thought about that. I've never seen that discussed anywhere. But somebody sent us a message from Mauritania saying, you know, this is an issue. You're not aware of it. I've never seen it discussed. Why not? Okay, let's discuss that. And I was overwhelmed with the responses. I got responses from Mauritania, from Morocco, from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, and personal stories. People went through difficult times simply because of their color in the Middle East. And that defies, you know, the general concept in the Middle East, you know, that most of our listeners have, or that we often sometimes have. We are subject to racism from the West. You know, we are, you know, pure and nice and kind to one another. It's not very true, or at least some people think it is not. I think it is very important in our business to be challenging. We are not there just to make people happy listening and hearing what they like to hear. We are there to give them another chance to test their views and ideas, and maybe they can come up with something different, and maybe not. Maybe they stick to their views. But this is part of what I think we should be doing. And I mean, these images on the left-hand side, bottom left, and these images are coming from users. They are coming from different parts of the Middle East. And I've seen some images that are much better than professional photography being sent to us. And we're running a competition on the site these days, bbcarabic.com, if you want to win a laptop. But just you have to send some pictures on Ramadan. I don't know how you can do that in London. Another example of something we have done and we are very proud of, this is the English version of it. It's the Omnia and Orly, pen pals. These are two mothers, one from Israel, one from Alexandria, introduced to one another by bbcarabic.com. The Egyptian lady has never met an Israeli lady before, and the Israeli lady has never met an Arab before. And they started corresponding together, introducing themselves, and talking about the current issues in the Middle East and raising questions about legitimacy, occupation, apartheid. And it was such strong content that we received messages from people saying that they are weeping while they're reading this exchange of emails. And the interesting thing here also is that not only the content itself was very interesting, to the extent that this was one of the top 10 stories on the BBC English site, which is a global site, and it was for at least a month one of the top stories on bbcarabic.com. And the reason is not the content itself alone, it's the meta content, the content that is coming about the content, the comments of users on the exchange of these emails. And it was one of the success stories that we have, when we try to see how we can incorporate user-generated content in a way that can be useful and enticing. Another one, which is I think it's a very unique one to the BBC. I don't think any other organization would be able to do that. That was a chat or a discussion about one of the topics in the Middle East. I don't remember if it was terrorism or something like that. And we sometimes share content with other services in the BBC. We have more than 40 different languages. Some of them have very strong big sites. And we tended to translate some of the views and the contributions that we receive. And Abdulaziz from Riyadh sent us a contribution that was incidentally translated and published in Spanish and Russian. Now, Vladimir, who is a visitor to bbcrussian.com, didn't like what Abdulaziz said. So he made a comment in Russian that was translated back into English, back into Arabic, put on the site. Abdulaziz, who originally put his original comment, saw the comment of Vladimir on bbcarabic.com. So he wrote again, commenting on what Vladimir has written. And that was translated back. And it was very interesting because if you see that, this is sort of a global interactive room, you know, across cultures and across languages, where Russians, Arabs, you know, Spanish people are exchanging views on the same topic. As I said, I don't think this can happen in any other organization. And this is just a sample of what interactivity did for us. And if you see, this orange line is sort of a measure of the traffic over the corresponding period, or the average of the corresponding people for the corresponding period. So if it's 6 o'clock today, it will trace that back to 4 times at 6 o'clock to see where that sits. And shortly after the news was released that about one of the early beheadings, actually, of the captives in Iraq, we started a forum on the issue, and that was around 7, 8 o'clock. And you can see the surge in traffic. It almost doubled. And online is a very interesting medium because you can almost track that down as it happens. So technology is not really... We're not talking about a new invention when we are talking about interactivity. It's not about red buttons and green buttons. It is not about dividing your screen into 3 or 4 or 6. I mean, it's multiple choice. It is not about, you know, opening a field and sending an email. It's not about using your device to access the internet. It's mainly about user-generated. It's an extension of what we have been doing. And what we are doing, and when we talk about interactivity, it's not really new. If you look at this, this is Al Ahram newspaper. This is the postman, as they call it, Al Ahram postman or Al Ahram post or something like this. And this is one of the very interesting examples of interactivity. I mean, interactivity we have seen in newspapers in the form of, you know, letter to the editor or feedback on what we publish, on what we write. But Al Ahram pushed it further, maybe a little bit, something like 15, 20 years ago, when the editor of this section decided to take it a little bit more further than just feedback on published articles or complaints or hobbyists sending their poetry. He started more of an interactive format where people started writing about issues similar to what professional newspapermen do, or analysts or writers. And it took off. I don't think anybody really sort of focused on that, but I think Al Ahram itself saw a surge in circulation, especially with the Friday issue when they expand this section to be a one full page. So it is not really something very new. And again, everybody now is trying himself with the medium. The repetition is not intended. This is Al Jazeera's site. And this is one of their sort of interactive programs. It's called Minbar Al Jazeera. It's called the Al Jazeera Forum, where users phone and talk about their views and explore different issues on the program. They do it slightly differently, or quite differently than how we do it. But again, as I said, everybody is trying to come to terms with what interactivity is about and how can we use it / exploit it to our benefit. One of the extreme examples of interactivity is Wikipedia. I don't know if you have seen that. This is a free encyclopedia on the net. And the users are actually the writers. And as it says on the front page, the first thing they like to teach you is how to edit a page. So it's not only that you contribute with the content, that anyone can contribute, anyone can edit. And I think this is the ultimate format of interactivity where the product itself will be what users create. Whether it's going to be a successful outcome or not, I don't know. But this is a very interesting experience in terms of interactivity. Interesting. There should be an image here. Yes, that's one. So if you are confused, I hope you're not. If you are confused, it's just simple. Interactivity is not just about engaging people. It's not just about getting them to listen to you. Interactivity is more about getting people to contribute and getting media professionals to have some respect for people and their views and to give them some space and to treat that content with respect that it deserves. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Before I open the discussion, or at least I ask for questions and comments, I need to remind myself to invite you to a reception in the senior common room following the lecture, because I'm bound to forget at the end of it. So following the talk and the discussion, you're warmly welcome at our reception in the senior common room in the L building. And those of you who don't know where it is, follow those who do, which is what we're going to do now. I throw it open to the floor. Questions, comments, disagreements, obviously, all welcome.
You can remake the presentation if you like. You can do it again if you want to.
Yes, here, and then at the back. We have a microphone, just in case you need to be heard, which you will do.
Well, there was a lot of, obviously, negative events in the Middle East recently. And there is an opinion that publicizing things like kidnapping and beheading people on the media, like Al Jazeera, etc., it's really encouraged the terrorists. And for some reason, in my uneducated opinion, Al Jazeera is the company, is the media which always publishes that somebody was beheaded or somebody was kidnapped, etc., etc. Can you comment a little bit about it?
Yes, I can. I mean, as you said, there are different views around that. First of all, I think we have the right to know. But how much should you see is a different question. That's my phone. I'm not going to answer, sorry. Let me just turn it off. But I just would like to contradict you a little bit in one aspect of what you said, because it seems to me that Al Jazeera broadcasts what it broadcasts because they receive it. And I could see that in the early days, for example, when they were receiving messages or video files or videotapes of Osama bin Laden, quite a number of the international broadcasting organizations were rebroadcasting that. So it doesn't seem to me that the objection always is about broadcasting this material. It might be on the monopoly of this material by Al Jazeera. And it seems to me that probably some of the organizations who do not publish this material, they would publish some of it if they receive it. This is one aspect. The other is, we are confronted with choices like that on a daily basis. And there is a limit. I do believe that there is a limit to what you can broadcast and what you shouldn't broadcast. For example, an operation took place and somebody was killed. And you get a videotape or a press release or an audio recording of somebody declaring responsibility. This for me is as far as it gets. As a radio station, I'm interested in voices. And I'm interested in authenticating the news that I'm putting on air. And this is as much as I can publish of that. But beyond that, I wouldn't publish it, i.e. afterwards, the threats that this message will be carrying to other individuals or other organizations is not something that I would be happy to put. The images of extreme violence is not something that I would be happy to put either on the site or to broadcast the audio of on the radio. So there is an issue of responsibility here. If you ask me whether this encourages or discourages people, I'm not sure that it really encourages, because again, the thought in itself reflects some kind of mistrust or distrust of the general population. You know, people are so naive to the extent that when they see this, they would like to do it, you know, themselves or something like this. You know. And I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't advise those who publish these videotapes to say something like, you know, don't try this at home or something. Don't try this at your country or something. It's not. This is not the issue. I mean, I think lots of people were dismayed, disappointed, disgusted with what they see. And I think it works both ways. It doesn't work only one way, if it works.
Good evening. My question really is probably more on a pragmatic level. Looking at the kind of services that you offer, you know, the forums that need to be generated, moderated, translated, etc., I'm interested to know how big your staff complement is at BBC Interactive.
BBCArabic.com is something like 25 people. That's it, really. But it's, I mean, translation is not the core business that we do. I mean, we do translate a number of comments every day to share with the rest of the service. That might be something like 10 comments or 10 contributions. But the site is updated on 24-hours basis. And the interactivity team itself within the BBCArabic.com is something like five or six people. So it's not a big team. But it's quite an interactive one. Well, that's it then.
No, it isn't. You see, I knew there'd be someone. And there will be more.
Thank you. I'd like to ask about popularity of Arabic service in its region. And does it feel concurrence nowadays from other broadcasters, radio broadcasters, as well as from TV broadcasters like Al Jazeera, Al Arabi, and others?
Sorry, I missed the first part. The BBC Arabic, you wanted to ask me about the BBC Arabic television?
Do people really listen to BBC Arabic service? Ah. What range? Is it audience big, large?
We have quite a large audience. We have quite a following in the Middle East, since the 30s of the last century. And if there is a competition, yes, there is competition in the Middle East. It's competition at least on people's time. I mean, in the past, people didn't have really enough of a choice. They had to either to listen to the BBC or some of the international broadcasters or their own state broadcasters. And I do remember the days when I had to, you know, to hide under my blanket with a small transistor, trying to, you know, catch the airwaves of the shortwave of different broadcasters, from Radio Albania to, you know, to Voice of America and Monte Carlo and the BBC. So there is quite a lot of competition now in the Middle East, especially with the introduction of Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera and lots of other TV stations. But I think the BBC has established itself, and the BBC and BBCArabic.com were established as some kind of a benchmark. And, for example, after the introduction of Al Jazeera website, we didn't notice any decline in our traffic, to the contrary. And it seemed to me, and also from talking to people, that people like to compare what we publish with what other organizations publish. So, in fact, it augmented what we do rather than created a competition that influenced us negatively. It didn't happen this way.
Can I ask a follow-up while everybody else is thinking about their questions? What changes, if any, did you notice in the response to the BBC Arabic during and after the invasion of Iraq? I mean, obviously, the BBC World Service seemed to be and expected to be a neutral voice, if that were possible. Has British government's involvement in Iraq made a difference to your relationship to your audiences, given your close relationship to your audience?
What happened is actually, especially with the introduction of the phone-in programs and the interactivity aspect of what we do, it helped us at least to demonstrate that we are there to demonstrate and incorporate all views on different issues, especially in relation to the war in Iraq. There still is some skepticism around, and people who are skeptical about the neutrality of the BBC, they would always try to find an occasion or part of the output that they would see as biased. But mm-hmm. What we are trying to do as much as we can is to make it clear that we are not the voice of the British government, that our affiliation with the government is very limited, and there is a board of governors, and there is a big structure behind the BBC editorial process to create the barrier between the politics and what we do. So I don't think that we have been influenced negatively after the war because of the British involvement in the war itself.
Yes. One, two. Three. So one just here. Yeah, thank you.
To what extent do the owners of Al Jazeera TV intervene, do you believe, in the daily policy of the organization?
It's difficult to, I mean, we have to define what the word intervene is. You know, it's an organization that has its own editorial policy and it follows its editorial policy. It seems to be pan-Arabist, pan-Islamist in a way. And it doesn't, I mean, the issue of neutrality is not there as much as it is for Al Jazeera, the issue of showing the other side of the equation, you know, challenging the predominant views in international broadcasting. So, I mean, from my experience in Al Jazeera, I haven't seen that sort of direct intervention there. And I wouldn't be able to comment on Al Jazeera after I left there.
Somewhere over here.
Hello. What I'd like to know is how you choose whom you interview and which contributions you post on site. What I mean is, if there are that many contributions, isn't it just coming back to the old problem of posting what you think people want to hear or what they want to read and just faking interactivity?
No, actually, it's a very interesting question because one of the most important aspects of working with interactivity is to understand who your audiences are, who are the shareholders there. And they are not actually the people who send you contributions. They are the people who consume your product. They are the users who read the website or the listeners who listen to a program. So what you need to do is to choose whatever you think would fulfill your needs to create a good product, i.e. there has to be color, diversity, and again, there are certain things that shouldn't be there, i.e. inciting hatred and violence and so on and so forth. So as much diversity as possible is what we are looking for. But it's not really about faking interactivity in a way or just writing for yourself and then publishing what you write for yourself. It's mainly about choosing what would make a good product. A range of views, a range of countries, a range of ages, a range of professions that would reflect sort of a complementing view on what people are thinking about.
I was wondering whether I last chairman's intervention follow up from that too, because when I saw the title of your lecture, and you may, I don't know whether you intended this or not, but the lecture was called Interactivity, Passing the Buck to the Audience. And I thought that what you were actually going to do was to engage in a critique of interactivity rather than support it, because there is a kind of irony passing the buck means handing over the responsibility. I just want to finish the question, which is, do you think passing the buck to the audience is in some sense for broadcasters in your domain as well as in others, a giving over of responsibility to the audience and failing to take it for yourself as a broadcaster?
No, I think we don't pass the responsibility. We don't give up the responsibility. That's the problem. We keep the responsibility. What we try to give up is the load of work. I mean, I was being pragmatic about it. In a good day when I was doing the program, I mean, I felt very good about the fact that I could moderate an interaction between a number of listeners, you know, a listener from Saudi Arabia talking to someone who lives in, you know, Korea, and another in Taiwan, and a fourth in the States. And, you know, if it's going well, then I sit back and I just let them run the show. Mm. And the more invisible I become, the better the show is. I had just to intervene when it's, you know, if it's going out of the realm of the discussion that we have decided for the program. So in a way, you know, addressing media professionals, I'm trying to say that, you know, I'm being an advocate of interactivity. I'm trying to say, well, this, you know, hang on, this is good for you. You know, it's you know, it's passing the buck in terms of passing the load of work to the listeners. It's as you said, it could be cheaper because if you are going to use analysts and pundits and publish their views and comments, it might cost us a lot. And to be honest, I think I have learned more from the views and the contributions that I'm receiving from listeners than quite a lot of what I see published by pundits and analysts, because I can't predict from the first line what they are going to say. There isn't really much there to say apart from what has been said, but people have really still more to say, and I could see that very few of, or quite a lot of their views is not represented in the media, and some of their ideas and thoughts are not reflected too.
Mm. There's someone here. No question? Yes, here. Please. Can you wait just a second for the mic to get to you? Put your hand up so they'll find you. Thank you.
Mine's not related to interactivity, but just a general question. Given that the BBC has created trust, as you mentioned, in the Middle East, with this BBC Arabic service providing an alternative point of view, do you find it unusual that other international news agencies have not set up similar services? And wouldn't that go a long way, though? But would that not go a long way in terms of their creating trust in the community or in the Islamic world in general?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't be able to talk about other broadcasters in terms of why or if they can create as much trust as the BBC has created in the Middle East. But they have already created. I mean, you have Radio Monte Carlo, you have an Arabic operation there, you have Voice of America before, and now you have Sawa. You have in the old times you had, as I said, Radio Albania South, and there was a Korean service, North Korean service. There is a Japanese Arabic service. There were quite a number of international broadcasters are in the market. Not all of them enjoy the same credibility and trust with the BBC.
So right at the end.
Good evening. I have a similar question. You mentioned something about to reach that certain point of interactivity. I imagine BBC will need a huge amount of resources, capital resources, human resources, and everything. What is your suggestion to other media organizations in poorer countries? Can they achieve that certain point of interactivity to develop that kind of program without the same resources as the BBC? Thank you.
Well, if you have a similar question, I'll give you a similar answer. No, I'm joking. It's a good point, but as I said, we don't really enjoy a lot of resources. I mean, we are more resourced than some other service in the BBC, but I don't think we are more resourced than quite a number of the media operations in the Middle East. As I said, the team in the BBC is a very small team. The interactivity team in particular is a very small team. And it isn't about how much you publish, it's about how diverse. Being able to represent reality is a tricky question because, I mean, interactivity is about using user-generated content. And in a way, you are trying to say that this reflects what people are thinking about. And to do that, it's a very tricky thing because you cannot just take anything and publish it. It's just like writing a novel that feels real. It definitely isn't real. And this is where it differs from interactivity, because interactivity is real, but it is not real, but it feels real because the writer is such a good writer that makes you feel that this is reality. But if you just take any narrative from real life, it might end up being unreal because of the way it was selected. So the selection process is the most important thing. And to be able to select, you don't have really to have a very big team, but you have to be able to have a team that understands how to create a product that is diverse, colorful, and representative.
Yes, here. Hold on. Wait for the mic. Another one over there. Now we're rolling.
Yeah, I have a question concerning about the production process. For example, how do you decide your editorial policy and what kind of topics you are going to have for one day? What kind of program will be on the top? And how do you, put these programs together to convey to the audience that it's interactive, it will attract the audience?
Well, the selection process involves looking into two areas, actually. One is looking into what we call the free area. This is an area on the site where we ask people to publish their suggestions and contributions on the current events. And secondly, we do brainstorm. So this small team of producers, they sit together and they decide what the agenda of the day will be. And it's sometimes interesting to, I mean, interactivity is a very tricky thing. One day we had two themes, and I decided to go for a vote. I said, okay, we're going to put a vote on the site, and people will decide whether they are going to take that option or that option. And it was, let's say it was something like Palestine and the Palestinian territories issues and violence in the Palestinian territories and things like that. And there was another issue, I don't remember what, but it was a slightly different, it was not political. The voting was such that most people voted for Palestine and the Middle East sort of violence. And the contributions that we received were predominantly for the other light-hearted issue, which made me think that probably people were voting in exactly the same way as media professionals think. You know, this is an important issue, we should talk about it. But when it came to contributions, people didn't write anything different than what is predominant. I mean, most of the views were there, I mean, the common views, nothing really that would entice me to read. So they thought that this is what we should talk about, but at the same time, when they contributed something completely different. And this is what we have to suss out when we, you know, when we do our brainstorming. We try to see what would be interesting for people to talk about, rather than what is important to talk about. Oh, the sources that, we, I mean, the sources for interactivity or the sources for news and information? For programs, we have, you know, the usual resources. We have the news, the news agent. We don't imagine news. We have the news agencies, you know, we have Reuters, AFP, AP, all the news agencies that you know of. We have the BBC offices and bureaus across the world. We have the BBC correspondents. I mean, these are the usual resources that any news organization crafts its material from.
Right.
Sorry. One over here, and then one over here, and then one behind you. You've had a chance.
We discussed reality just briefly just a moment ago.
I didn't hear
reality.
That. Yeah.
You mentioned that interesting word. Do you think that in an interactive medium, given that I assume you're broadcasting from Bush House, do you consider reality to be similar across the whole world in producing a media product, an interactive, interesting product, or do you have to take into consideration other, so to speak, realities around the world? I mean, of course you do, and could you give us some more examples of how you actually approach this? Do you have local guys feeding... Do you have local people feeding you more information about what the topic is? How much will they sort of interact with you before the program starts? I would imagine it's a bit of a process to go through this.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about realities and assumptions. I mean, one of the realities is that we broadcast here from Bush House. I mean, this is not an assumption, as you said. You know, we broadcast from Bush House. Realities, yes, people have different perceptions of realities, but the thing that we have to suss out is what they would like to... I mean, to have a feel of the market and a feel of the audience is a very important thing. Because the abundance of information and news material is overwhelming, and the choice is a very critical process. And to do that, you have to be able to read your market. And this is why we have our correspondents across the Middle East. We have correspondents and offices in Jerusalem, in Cairo, in Amman, in Beirut, in different parts of the Middle East, and indeed in different parts of the world. So we try to use that to help us sort of craft our programs, to help us identify the needs for our audiences and create programs that would address these needs. I don't know if this answers your question.
What am I going to do, I think?
I'd like to... if there's some other...
There are people waiting. What I'm going to suggest is that we just take questions, two or three questions that are left on the floor, and then you can do a portmanteau answer, if that's okay. So one question there.
My question would be, do you think there's any potential danger in this medium of interactive media? Taking the recent example, there was on Star News in India, there was this question, an opinion poll stating that, do you think the increase in the Muslim population in India would be a danger for the unity and integrity of the country? Now, if we are asking such questions in the media, do you not think we are injecting communal views or misleading or just is it not harmful in any way?
You're right. I mean, one of the most difficult things is putting a question for vote, and we sit, you know, for I wouldn't say long hours, but quite a long time, trying to decide what sort of question can be appropriate to put there, because any question can be taken as an assumption in itself, and it's just as if you're asking your audiences to endorse an assumption that is embedded in the question. So questions for voting is a very tricky thing, and I wouldn't advise trying it at home. So you are right. You might be inciting hatred if you do that, and also if you remember that some people can use some programlets to keep on voting on one of the options, then it becomes problematic, and then that can be used. You know, the majority of Indians think that, and you know, even with the disclaimer underneath that this is not representative of the population, it's just representative of the views of those who use the voting module. But again, it doesn't work. So I think it has to be taken with a great deal of caution. Yeah.
One more, please.
I'm wondering if maybe, I don't know, but do you find you have to be self-censoring in a particular way, which I'll mention? You're obviously asking for lots of people's contributions on a wide variety of subjects, whether political or about violence and so on, all sorts of things. Are you able or do you want to elicit and broadcast views about religion? I mean, let's say we're talking about the Middle East, but I came to this question thinking about, gosh, that interactivity sounds wonderful, hearing the real people's view. Why can't my church, the Church of England, elicit all our views in the pews, if you like? Because it is rather authoritarian and hierarchical. And now I'm wondering, are you able in the Middle East to have people saying different views of what their version of Islam might suggest in this position or that? Or do you think, no, religion, we better keep off it?
No, we have. Well, I mean, we have done that more than once, and the issue of religion, you know, pops up every now and then, whatever the issue is. And again, it depends what the contribution is about. If it's inciting hatred against Muslims or Christians or whatever, then it's not a contribution that we publish. But I was just looking at our site yesterday, and there was a discussion about creativity and why. Is there a perception that in the Middle East creative people seem to leave the country or seem to leave the Middle East and so on? And quite a number of contributors said, well, actually religion is the reason. You know, the way we interpret our religion is the reason because of that. You know, it's stifling. People feel that they cannot really express their views. We ran discussions on when there was a fatwa at some stage, when Al-Azhar issued a fatwa against a book that was last year. We had that in discussion. We had somebody from Al-Azhar, we had the author of the book on air, we had people on air saying, you know, this is not on, you know. Religion is not about exercising authority in that way. And it's not something that we would shy away from.
Last question on my right here. Somebody, a friend of yours, I think.
Having spent a considerable amount of time looking at other parts of the BBC, Hossam, in your career, what do you think that programs such as The World Today or the Today program on Radio 4 can learn in terms of interactivity? Where I think the Arabic service, in my opinion, is light years ahead. What can they learn?
Light years ahead.
Well, I'm too small to answer this question. I do believe that programs like The World Today, which I have enjoyed working with for about 2 or 3 or 4 months now, is a program that we would like to craft a similar program in the Arabic service like it. And I think one of the most important things for early morning program is this breakfast feel. It's not about bombarding people in the morning with news of explosions and death. And I mean, you will have to tell them that. But I mean, I still believe that you can talk to people about these issues in a more friendly way, in a more interactive way, in a more engaging way. It's not interactivity in the traditional sense, in the sense that I was talking about. It's interaction between presenters and creating that feel that the listener is also part of the program, that we can talk about any issue without being sometimes patronizing or imposing, but it's just a remark. I mean, don't put that on the record, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, in my view, there's nothing wrong with being small.
And I'd like on that note to thank Hossam very much for a very interesting and provocative lecture. Thank you very much indeed.